My Family Recipe is a new podcast from Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network, bringing you cherished heirloom recipes and the stories behind them. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, your weekly wine journey. Our guest is Christoph Baron. We'll talk to Christoph about making wine in the Pacific Northwest, Champagne, and his multitude of projects. We'll taste the horsepower Syrah for our weekly wine sip. I'm your host, Sam Ben Ruby. Stay with us for the Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We bring wine to the people. Christoph Baron's family dates back to the mid-17th century in Charles-sur-Marne. In Champagne. He studied viticulture in Champagne and Burgundy. After meeting an American in Burgundy, Christoph was convinced to head west to Oregon and Washington and discovered their stony vineyards. He bought his first vineyard back in 1997 and farms biodynamically. Christoph has unstoppable energy, ambition, curiosity, and a respect for the land. His Bionic Wines portfolio is mind-boggling, including Champagne, Christoph Baron, Cayuse, Or Categorie, Horsepower, and No Girls. Christoph's wines have reached cult status along with critical acclaim. The question to Christoph, is all that enough? And what's next?
Hello, Sam. Thank you for having me.
Welcome to the Grape Nation, Christoph Baron. I've been meaning to have you on forever, and I'm glad that we could sound. Christoph, we're talking to you. Where are we, you and I? Where are we sitting?
We are sitting on the 14th floor of the One Hotel on 1414 58th Avenue in the corner of 58th and 6th Avenue, Manhattan.
So it's fortuitous for me that you and I get to sit in person. Why are you in New York?
Because I love New York, and it's reopening, and last weekend there was like Fête du Champagne, and it's an amazing event that is organized by several wonderful sommeliers, Daniel Jones, and also Peter Lim, and it's a great event. As I said, it's always fun to visit with some old friends from Champagne, and also make new friends there.
I was at the Grand Tasting, and it probably is the greatest collection of champagne makers in one room, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, it was great. All right, let's get started. People may know your wines. They may be regular drinkers. They may pull them out in restaurants, but they may not know a lot about you. So quickly, tell me about your journey in life and wine that got you really to where you are today, which is this whole Bionic Wines empire. And this goes back to your family in Champagne.
Sure, like what you said, I'm originally from Champagne, from the Marne Valley, a small village called Charly-sur-Marne, where my family has been a family of vignerons over there since the 17th century, and more exactly 1677. Several centuries, yes. Indeed. Long time ago. And then I decided at age 15 to become a vigneron. This is what I said to my dad. And my parents sent me to Avis to study viticulture and enology there. I spent 3 years
so
there.
So they encouraged it?
Yes, absolutely, okay. Completely. Right. I think my dad was very happy about it. And then from there, I did transfer to Burgundy, to Beaune, to finish my degree in viticulture and enology. And then I did University of Dijon there. I studied there. And then at the time, that was back in the late 80s, and the big buzz in Burgundy and in Beaune was DDO, Domaine Drouin, Oregon. And what the Drouin's family has done in
the
Willamette Valley.
So they were the first to make that move, or they were early?
They were the first.
And back home, people were like, what's going on?
What's going on?
Really?
Yes, and I really developed a passion and a love for still Chardonnay and Pinot Noir in Burgundy, obviously. And I said, I want to go there. I want to see what's going on in the Willamette Valley. I feel like I need to go and explore that new frontier.
there were no other places that evoked that kind of curiosity? I mean, that was the place?
That was the place because of the Drenz family.
It's crazy. All right, so keep going.
Then this is where I ended up in the Pacific Northwest in 1993. I said I would like to get a job there. So I applied for a visa. I got a visa for 18 months as an intern. And I could not find a job in the Willamette Valley at the time for more than 3 months, basically working harvest. And I really wanted to spend more than 3 months in
the United States. So the jobs were turnover jobs.
Right.
Like do this and then you're out, next.
Exactly. Okay. And a friend of mine called me. I was still in France and we went to college together and he said, hey, Christophe, I've got to go back to France. My visa is going to expire. And my boss in Walla Walla is looking for a new intern to replace me. And this is actually how I ended up in Walla Walla. I look at the map mound, and I look at Walla Walla and McMinnville, and on the map mound, that was very only a centimeter and a half. And I was like, oh, close enough. And I arrived in Walla Walla in the spring of 1993, and I drove my bug convertible there on a weekend to the Willamette Valley, and this is the first time in my life I realized how big and huge this country is.
Yeah. When your friend turned you on to the job, was it a winery or
yes.
What was it?
Yes. I
mean, was it anything anybody would know at this point?
Well, it was a winery job.
Okay.
I spent over 1 year working for Waterbrook Winery in Walla Walla.
Okay. All right. So you obviously do that for a few years. Take me to the point where, I mean, what compels you to, did you always want to own your own vineyard? Were you always looking for property? I mean, how did that progression go?
Absolutely. So the idea was spending 1 year in Walla Walla, and then I was able to work the harvest of 1994 for David Adelsheim at Adelsheim Vineyards.
Legendary.
Great vigneron there. And then after that, I went back to France. And every time I will go back to France, my dad will ask me the same question. Son, when are you going to come back and work for the family business? And I told him I was not interested yet. I still wanted to travel and learn more about the new world wine industry.
Did you have siblings where, you know, you and them could do it, or if one of them didn't do it, you know, your other siblings would? I mean, did your dad feel that it was secure in the family, or how'd that work out?
I have one sister and I've got many, many cousins, but I'm the oldest of the son, you know, of the boys there. So that's the reason why it sounds like it was some kind of like important for my dad, for me to come back.
Sure. So I'm getting a little ahead because you still have to finish the story, but at some point you commit to the Walla Walla Valley, but you're also involved with the family, but you also have your own champagne. So those are questions that we have to answer. Don't get the air. Finish the thing. So you're working with Adelsheim, your friend got you a job earlier on. When do things become your own?
Back in 1996, after working in Australia and New Zealand and then in Romania, then this is when I sat down with my father and the family and told them that I was not interested actually to work.
Oh boy.
With a family business. My father understood it. My mom
it wasn't
had a
shock,
very hard
right?
time. It was not a shock.
Your
it
mother was sad because you weren't going to be around.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so this is when I told my family, look, I would like to go back to the Willamette Valley. I had some saving at the time, and I'm going to look for land there. I would like to purchase 10 to 20 acres and plant Chardonnay and Pinot Noir. That was the plan. But on my way to the Willamette Valley, I stopped in Walla Walla to spend some time with one of my friends and to recover my car that I left over there. And everywhere I will go, I will always travel with my French wine atlas. And then I was with Scott Byerly. He's a local farmer, a wheat farmer in Walla Walla. And we were having aperitif one of these nights. And then I show him the French atlas and photos of Châteauneuf-du-Pape, of the great vineyards of the Southern Rhone. And I told Scott, look where we grow vineyards in France, in some very, very inhospitable, stony soil.
And he goes. So you found a vineyard site. What was this, 96?
96.
I would guess that the sites you found, most people would probably pass on. I mean, you're talking about fields of softball-styled stones.
Right.
People look at that and go, "What the? You know, what the hell am I going to do?" So why set up there?
Well, because when Scott saw the photos and he said, "Well, I know where there is some stones like these in a valley," I'm like, "Wow, can you tell me there tomorrow morning, please?" Because literally, I was leaving for the Willamette Valley the next day.
Right.
The next day. And he took me there, and this is when I first discovered the stones of the Walla Walla Valley. And there's orchards everywhere planted there. There's cherries, apples, fruit orchards. And there was a 10-acre block that was an open field and just covered and littered with cobblestones there.
So what you found in Walla Walla, did you think you would possibly come across that in Willamette Valley? I mean,
no,
did you?
Not at all.
So what you discovered kind of set you up for what you were going to grow and somewhat of a dream fulfilled.
Yes,
that challenge, right?
Absolutely. And everything because of that discovery that day. That was pure serendipity. And I decided actually to stay in Walla Walla and to purchase that piece of land and to plant Syrah, mainly Syrah and Viognier at the time.
So I don't know if everybody knows this. I mean, if they know certain areas, certain wines, tell people the effect that growing vineyards in very stony, you know, terroir and where the soil is not, you know, deep and rich. It's probably like a topsoil. What effect does that have on the wine? I mean, what, it's obviously something you wanted and you were looking for, but what does that produce for you?
There's a common denominator with great terroir all over the world. That means very shallow topsoil and great subsoil in terms of like mineral, like limestone in Burgundy, chalk in Champagne, and you go so on and so on, gravel in Bordeaux, granite in Northern Rhone, slate in Germany,
right,
and et cetera, et cetera. So those cobbles are the same. I mean, it's very, very poor. And my great-grandfather used to say, if you can grow wheat, don't bother planting a vineyard. That means, in other words,
it's more practical, but
yes, but to have a really sense of terroir and the best wine, you need to have the vines needs to struggle. This is as simple as that.
So, talk a little more about that. By being around stones and poor soil, they have to fight to survive, right? So, they're going deeper or they're spreading out. Tell me
the roots. The roots go deeper because they have like to search for this water, for the moisture, and then therefore they're gaining the true essence of terroir by just sending their roots very, very deep.
So by doing that, and it kind of goes back to my original question, by doing that, they're finding, you know, moisture and they're going deep. Then you're getting the true expression of the terroir.
Absolutely, because
what the composition is, they're
yes,
set up in there.
This is liquid stones. This is what it's all about. And that you cannot get that with a root system that is very superficial and stay on the surface. And the stones are very loose, so that's very easy, actually, for the root system to find their way down.
Because they could move around. It's not like rock solid or sheets of, you know, slate or whatever.
Absolutely.
So the effect on the fruit is what you've been talking about? Is it sort of a liquid stone, stony? I mean, is that the expression that gets passed along?
I like to use that word, liquid stone. It's pretty much what it is. And of course, you've got great sense of terroir over there. That means that savoriness that comes from the stones is very savory. You have a lot of salinity coming from those wines, a lot of umami. The fruit character is not what comes first out of those wines.
So wait, for me. So planting there There's a salinity. I want to repeat this. People say I repeat a lot, but there's a salinity and umami, which is a savoriness. That you would get in that type of setup that you wouldn't just get, you know, in the Columbia Gorge or Willamette or whatever.
Or even somewhere else in the Walla Walla Valley.
It's super unique.
It's super unique. It's a very unique area, this alluvial fen of the ancient riverbed of the Walla Walla River. It's about, what, over 3,500 acres. So it's pretty small if you look at it.
So here's what I don't understand. So you come from a historic French Champagne family. You study in Burgundy. You work harvests around the world. How do you wind up in a stony vineyard focusing towards Rhone-type? You know, why? I mean, was this something that you always thought about? Did it hit you when you saw that? I mean, it's kind of unusual.
Indeed, because normally,
if you made Burgundy or stayed in Champagne, that would make sense. This is like the opposite.
Yes, but I really like this essence of pioneer.
Okay.
That's the first thing. I love that. Then I should have been in the Willamette Valley without discovering the stones. Then, you know, I took the risk to stay and say, I'm going to stick there. And for a simple reason, I look at the great opportunity. First of all, if I would have moved in the Willamette Valley, I would always have been on the coattail of Véronique Drouin.
Drouin, right.
Right, I would not have been the first French vigneron there.
Which is what drew you there, but...
Right, and more power to the family there. But there, I would have been the first French vigneron in Walla Walla, planting in the terroir that hasn't been discovered yet. In fact, there was a vineyard in the stones up until the late 50s. So I consider myself planting the first commercial vineyards since then.
Right. And as we get into the show, you'll see that you haven't stopped there. So it was sort of an act of, I don't know what you'd call it, you know, renegade, or mm-hmm. I came here for this, but screw that. I'm going to do this. I mean, your life would have changed if you pulled into Walla Walla and stayed, I mean, into Willamette if you stayed there. No regrets, right?
No regrets at all.
All right. I think that's a lot of fun. It's ironic how you took it to, you know, the next level. I mean, one of your wineries, which we'll talk about, Ors Categorie, is really a replica of, you know, the Northern Rhone. I mean, I think as you spend time there, you really, really got deeper into the vision. All right, so let's talk about your wineries, all right? Each one has a different story. I think each one came about, you know, for different reasons. One of the things I want to ask you, and I wrestle with this, is I see old world thinking and winemaking, and I see new world. I guess I may answer your question and say that you merge both, but I mean, aren't you looking to the old world, and don't you have new world ideas on how you want to approach these vineyards and the wines?
Well, absolutely. This being said, the tradition is everything. And all the ideas are coming from the old world, are coming from France, are coming from Champagne, Burgundy, Northern Rhone, Southern Rhone. And I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel here. In fact, there is no need to reinvent the wheel. But looking
at... You got rid of the wheel.
Right.
We'll talk about that, but go ahead.
It means like re-looking and finding some very unique terroir with great potential. And then starting to plant the way, like everyone else, were planting at the time in the Walla Walla Valley with minimal funding. And then we started like to be more popular, and the wines became very well known. And obviously, the business was more financially sound, and I reinvested in vineyards. I'm completely obsessed with vineyards and viticulture because this is where the foundation is for great wine. And that means trying new things in the vineyards, higher density planting, things like that. You know, when we started Cayuse, we planted the vineyard. They were 10 feet between the rows and 4 feet between the vines. Up until 2000. In 2001, I decided actually to experiment and plant more vines per acre or per hectare, and we went 6 feet between the rows and 4 between the vines.
So what does that do to the fruit and what kind of wine? I mean, what's the difference that you've, you know, created by doing that? I mean, it was an experiment. You had the product, the fruit. You made the wine. I mean, what did you find?
Well, we found out that actually the rows being closer to each other, they have more shade in the fruit zone. And what means that actually it takes longer for the fruit to ripen, a little longer, 5 days usually, maybe a little less, 7 days, a good week there. And actually the wines are different, completely different. We found out that they're still very, there's nice fruit quality, like the first vineyards that were planted. This being said, you also have in the mouth feel something that is a wine with more tension and more structure. So for me, that was like a big eye-opening. I saw, more vines to the acre. Then four, I've got an interesting mouthfeel, more tannins, more structures.
It sounds like it worked out well.
It worked very well.
Yeah.
And this is Armada. This is good.
Were the yields bigger? Because not that that was necessarily your goal, but in the end, were the yields bigger?
Well, a little bigger, but not too much.
Nothing crazy, right?
Nothing crazy, because we kept the dropping more fruit on the ground.
Right. Whatever it took to keep the existing vines.
Absolutely.
One of the things I love about you, and you really haven't talked about it, but it's, you know, very, very admirable, is the way you farm. In reality, your family were farmers and you're a farmer. As much as we're galloping around New York and going to champagne festivals, you got to get your ass back in the field soon. You've made a big commitment to organic and biodynamic farming, which in reality is the direction everyone should be going, but they're not, but you are. When, why, and how, you know, did all that happen? I guess some of the answer is obvious, but tell me.
Since we planted the first vineyard in 1997, we've been organic and farming with an organic approach. This being said, there's no certification there. And then in 2002, we decided actually to switch from organic farming to biodynamic.
Why?
Farming. Why?
I mean, they're very different. There's a bigger commitment to biodynamics. You were ready for that? I mean,
I was ready for that for a simple reason is when I was studying in Burgundy, I read a great article in La Revue des Vins de France, and I was about biodynamism and Nicolas Joly and La Coulée de Seron in the Loire Valley in Savenière. And I read this article and I was very intrigued by this article. And at the end, there was like actually the list of the vignerons that were starting to embrace and experiment with biodynamic farming. And I was like very surprised that some of them were here in my backyard in Burgundy. And one was La Loubise-Leroy, famous domaine Leroy, and also Anne-Claude Leflève from Domaine Leflève in Puy-Montrachet.
Among the biggest names.
The biggest name. And I had the chance to test wine from Le Clos Voyant when they were doing actually some experiment there with like conventional farming and organic farming and biodynamic farming. And the biodynamic wines, to me, was always had the best expression of the terroir and had so much more salinity and freshness and real sense of terroir, of place, that I knew one day in my career as a vigneron, I will have to embrace those techniques.
And the conventional farming, when you compared, was so far away from that.
So less.
There wasn't that expression, that energy, whatever you describe.
Absolutely. Those wines were kind of boring.
So you just needed a little proof to keep you on the right track. What about in the cellar? I mean, obviously, you're not going to farm biodynamically and then start playing around with the wines. I mean, tell me about your philosophy in the cellar. Obviously, low intervention.
Low intervention. I think you have to put the ego of the vigneron on the side. It's very, very important.
What does that mean? Not what you want, but what the...
What the what the fruit dictates.
Okay.
This is all about the fruit.
It's not your style. It's what the fruit says.
Yes. And obviously what I like style-wise.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
If you ask me what my favorite wine from Burgundy, Northern Rhone, Southern Rhone, we can talk about that. So, but once you define your style or the style of wine that you really like, then, of course, with the farming, it's 90% of the quality of a bottle of wine. Then after that, you can fine-tune inside and in a wine studio. Okay, but that means basically test every day, every time during fermentation, and decide exactly what you are going to do, what kind of punch on, the intensity of the punch down, of the pump over, and so on. So there is no recipe.
It's different for every wine every year?
Every year and every day.
That's crazy. You mentioned something, if I ask you your favorite Burgundy. Now, the wines that you make, are they inspired by the styles of the wines that you admired?
Absolutely.
And they are?
Well, Northern Rhone, obviously, because we are talking mainly about Syrah. And,
right,
of course, Grenache. So Northern Rhone is Domaine Jamais. Of course, it's Gonon, it's Clap, in Cornas.
There's a whole bunch of guys.
It's Bernard Faury in Hermitage. And it's always vigneron that use some whole cluster.
So I was going to ask you, so you do mostly whole cluster?
I really enjoy working with the whole clusters. They have to be ripe, of course.
Right.
It's very, very important. And
but finish, I'm sorry.
Yes. And then so we use a fair amount of whole cluster. Again, there's no recipe. You test the stems and you decide. Some years 100% on some blocks. Some years it's like 60%, 70%, all across the board there.
That's what I was going to ask. You'll make the changes necessary based on the fruit.
Based on the fruit and based on the year.
Yeah. All right. So we're talking to Christoph Baron. We're going to have to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk about all of Christoph's wineries, projects, things that he's doing. And I promise you that'll offer a lot more insight into what's going on in Walla Walla, what he's doing, Champagne. So you're listening to The Grape Nation on the Heritage Radio Network. We'll be right back.
Good food is worth a thousand words. This is Aarti Menon, and I'm delighted to share a new podcast with you, My Family Recipe, from Food 52 and Heritage Radio Network. Adapted from Food 52's much-loved column of the same name, the My Family Recipe podcast will bring its pages to life. Each episode of My Family Recipe brings you a cherished heirloom recipe and the story behind it, from voices across the world of food.
We'd open these tubs of dough and they would exhaust these incredible yeasty fumes, and it just smelled like nothing else. It was so intoxicating.
I'll interview writers and chefs, parents and children, about what's passed down along with the foods that we know and love.
Chinese people aren't like born with a download on how to like velvet chicken. You know, like that's not something that just like comes to you.
Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, we're back. We're back with my guest, Christoph Baron. Christoph oversees, I guess at some point in his life, he said, I'm going to call all of this Bionic Wines. Now, Christoph makes a wine called Bionic Frog, which is a legendary wine. We'll get to that. But now we're going to break down Bionic Wines. So the obvious thing to start with is Champagne. It's in your blood, and it's a project right now that I think you're spending a lot of time with. I think Champagne, Christoph Baron, is unique in many ways. You know, you and I just tasted 40, 50 champagnes in 2 hours
yes,
a few days ago. Tell me about this. I mean, we're talking single vineyard, single grape. I mean, there's a vision here, and I think people are going to realize that, you know, when you put your mind to something. So tell me about Champagne Christoph Baron.
It's a very unique process. Obviously, it's very, very interesting because I was not interested to take the business over, and I decided to spend 25 years in the United States developing Bionic Wines and vineyards in Walla Walla. And then back in 2003, my parents decided to actually give their vineyard to my sister Isabelle and myself, and we sat around the table. And my father said, okay, here are all the vineyards, and you're going to
Everything?
Decide. All the vineyards are there, and we need to divide up. You know, Isabelle, you're
so
going...
So that was their... movement out of
movement.
The day-to-day, you know, being vineyard owners and owning champagne. Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Because they...
Was that a surprise or did
no,
you expect...
No, not at all. You have to plan ahead because of French taxes, inheritance taxes. So you have... were very high, unfortunately, but you have to plan ahead. So that's what they did. And they asked us what we wanted, you know, if we have a preference. And I'm like, well, if I could actually have some old... vineyard Pinot Meunier, I will be very delighted. And my sister was like, well, I will be fine to have like younger vineyards because my sister sells her fruit.
And the Chardonnay.
And Chardonnay and Pinot Meunier also, but she sells the fruit to the family. So having like younger vineyards for her who produce a little more was okay. And for me, I wanted to have the old vines there. And because I had the plan of creating a small brand of vineyard designated, single grapes, Pinot Meunier, Champagne.
Pinot Meunier only.
Pinot Meunier only, because it's where we're from in Charly-sur-Marne. This is the kingdom of Pinot Meunier. This is the west part of the Marne Valley. We live only 69 kilometers north-east of Paris, very close to the capital. And this is what Pinot Meunier does, perform the best in our area.
So... you get the family vineyards. It's now yours. How does this progress? I mean, do you start making your own champagnes right away? Are you selling? I mean, when does Champagne Christophe Baron sort of hit the bottle in the market?
First, we started with a 2014 vintage.
Okay,
so I sat down around the table with my cousins, with Lise, Claire, and Aline. So three wonderful women. And I said, I would like to, every year, create one champagne from one vineyard and take one vineyard back every year, but still sell you some fruit. So it has to be a win-win situation for everyone. So I still sell some fruit to the family and they take care of my project and they follow my protocol in terms of farming and the creation of the wine in a cellar.
That's crazy. No dosage.
No dosage.
Single vineyard. No. Let's tell people no dosage means you add no sugar.
No sugar disgorgement. We don't add any sugar. So it's a brut nature. So in other words, I say no maquillage, no makeup. This is definitely the pure essence of Pinot Meunier.
What? How many vintages? I mean, where are we at now? You started in 2014?
With one wine, one parcel in 2015, with two different wines, 2016, three different wines, 2017, again, three different parcels. And in 2018, we're adding a fourth parcel. And it's very fond to my heart because it's located in a little hamlet called Porteron, where the family is from. And that vineyard was planted in 1925. This is my oldest vines.
So before we move on, tell me two things. I think virtually everyone's drank champagne. I don't think they know what the blends are. Some people don't even know that it's blended. And Pinot Meunier is certainly the outlier. You know, when you think, hey, there's Blanc de Blancs and, you know, Noir. What are the characteristics of a Meunier-only champagne compared?
Usually a Meunier is very round in the mouth, is fruit forward, and it's very easy to drink.
That sounds like what most people would love.
Would love, exactly.
Right.
This being said, when Meunier is planted in very heavy clay with old vineyards and low yield, you are creating some wines with definitely more depth, more density, and more tension as well. And this is what I'm trying to create with the style of champagne at Champagne Christophe Baron.
Are you there? I mean, are you tasting it? Are you getting there? Or it's still vintage by vintage? I mean, are you accomplishing those goals?
We're accomplishing those goals. Absolutely. And actually, since the first millésime, first vintage, definitely you can tell that were already there because the vines are like over 50 years old.
Right. So what's interesting is you have to be one of the newer champagne makers and companies, you know, in the Champagne region. I'm sure there's other people, but when you think about all the names people know, I mean, the family has been around, but your brand is the new guy on the block.
New guy on the block. And this is very interesting because it's Champagne is like an El Dorado. It's like Texas probably over 100 years ago when they're tapping the soil there to get oil. There is new grower champagne every year. It's just unbelievable. And thanks to people like Anselm Celos, who already started the movement, respect to Anselm right there. And then to the new generation that are actually following this approach. I mean, it's just unbelievable
movement.
What's going on in Champagne.
It's unbelievable. I mean, the whole grower movement, everything. All right, so that's Champagne Christophe Baron. We are in New York. We are in the United States. Is it available?
Absolutely.
Is it a restaurant wine? Is it in certain retail? I mean, people are going to say, wow, that sounds pretty cool. Where do I get it?
Well, you get it. Like if you, first of all, we sell about 90% of the champagne through our mailing list privately to our clients.
And then, okay, so mailing list is the play.
And 10% goes actually to a great distributor like Skernig, for instance.
Right.
And they find their place in the best wine shop.
They know
and
where
best
to
restaurants.
Get it out
absolutely.
To. Yeah, absolutely.
But you know, the production is very limited. It's about 1,500 magnums per parcel. So altogether, 6,000 magnums for the world.
Right. So it is pretty rare. I mean, so you have to pay attention. All right, let's move on. We're going to talk about Horsepower Vineyards, which is certainly your nod to the past. But before we get into that, you know, we have a segment at the end of the show called the Weekly Wine Sip where we taste and evaluate a wine. But we've opened the wine already. We'll talk about it later. But I just want to say that Christophe and I are sitting here sipping on a 2014 Horsepower, the Tribe Syrah. And we'll talk about all its characteristics. But this is truly, you know, another interesting vineyard. When I say it's a nod to the past, I mean, not hard for you to explain. Tell me, you know, why you wanted to do all of this and what it is.
It is a very interesting question because, as I said, going from low-density planting to moderate density planting with cayuse and being with biodynamic farming methods, I thought it was very important actually to close the circle. And what does it mean? It means to bring the animal element on the properties. And that means to plant some vineyards who are very high density, 3.5 feet by 3.5, which means about 3,550 vines per acre.
So 3.5 feet from each vine and across to the next row is 3.5.
Absolutely.
And that's as dense as it comes?
Well, it could be denser
than
that.
But that's pretty damn dense, right?
For the United States, it's very dense.
Okay.
And it's each vine actually is trained on its own stake there, like very much like in the Northern Rhone. And the reason why I decided also to do that, because I saw that having more vines per acre, adding some concentration, but also some density and structure to the wines. And guess what? We planted the first vineyard in 2008. Tribe was planted in 2009. The first wine actually was released in 2011. And right away, we saw the great potential of those vineyards because of that structure and tension in the wines. Great verticality.
So you're not mentioning two things, which are pretty interesting. The vines are farmed not mechanically, and they're certainly not on flat land. So tell me more about that.
The horsepower are on flat land.
Horsepowers?
Yes.
Oh, I'm thinking of a category.
Right.
I'm sorry. The horsepowers. But my bad. But it's farmed
with draft horses. Do the name Horsepower. So we started with one draft horse in 2008, and now we have 6 draft horses. 5 different vineyards for a total of almost 19 acres. So can you imagine every time you take the horses for a pass to cultivate and to keep the weeds down, it's about 50 miles that you have to be behind a horse. So we have several teamsters, of course. It's a very, very physical work, but that's what it takes.
And so there's four vineyards, six horses, like you said, tightly spaced. Let's talk about the wines. So you're making the Tribe, which we're drinking now.
Right.
Sur, you helped me with my French, Echalas.
Sur Echalas, which means on the steak. We have a Grenache and a Syrah there. Then we have High Contrast. It's another vineyard, 100% Syrah. And we have Fiddleneck, which is like really focused on Grenache. And we planted a fifth vineyard 3 years ago. It's called Alogo, which means actually horse in Greek.
Ah, so very Rhone, very Syrah, a little Grenache. The current vintage is what?
2018.
18. And that's, again, that's available in the market mostly through mailing list.
Through the mailing list, yes. It's good like to be on the mailing list, but we also sell to distributors and restaurants. Okay. So it's available in New York and on both coasts.
So that's horsepower. Horsepower is very interesting because you decided to approach the farming a different way. I don't think a lot of people would have the patience or, you know, whatever.
Well, that's very interesting. I was talking with a Champenois à la Fête du Champagne. In fact, Jean-Baptiste
Lecaillon
from Roderer there, and I, because they also farm with draft horses at Roderer there, about 40 hectares. And I told him, I showed the photo, and it's like, that's good. There's some crazy Frenchmen in America, too.
It's spread over here.
So that means, I took that as a compliment, believe me.
So planting close together definitely has an effect on the wine.
Ah, completely.
By using horses, the land is treated differently because you're not tilling, it's not mechanical. Does that have a major effect on, you know, how the wines turn out? Or
actually, it's more of the quality of the soil. So it's very loose soil. That means the soil are not compacted. Just the pressure near the root system is very low. That means the root system goes very, very deep there. And of course, it has a quality on the final product, on the fruit that you harvest.
All right, so that's Horsepower Vineyards. Let's talk about another interesting project. The nice thing is everything's interesting, so it's easy and fun to talk about. You have a winery called No Girls Wines.
Right.
All right. The nice thing I saw about this is you've had an assistant winemaker for many years, which is a nice thing.
Right.
And she's been very much involved in this project, Elizabeth. So I'll set this up. This is a winery where you say you empowered women to create empowered wine. So it's empowered women creating empowered wine.
Right.
So obviously you woke up one day and what did you say? There's not enough women in the industry. There's not enough representation. They're not getting the recognition or respect. How does No Girls come about?
That's a very good question. First, I would like to say that there is no winery, there is a wine studio.
Which is an interesting story on its own.
Exactly.
Because the name came from there.
Well, and there is no winemaker at Cayuse, and there's no assistant winemaker. There is a vigneron and there's an assistant vigneron. So we create, we don't make. This is our approach here. There is that crafting approach. And basically, the reason why No Girls, I bought some building downtown Walla Walla back in early 2000, and that was the oldest brothel in Walla Walla that closed in the late 50s. And when you go upstairs, nothing has changed. And on the wall, it's painted No Girls.
That's it.
That's it. So we thought, actually, you know, that Walla Walla was not as glamorous as it is right now.
Then, as now.
Then, yeah. Exactly. So never forget your roots and your past. And Walla Walla should not forget their past. And that's the reason why we decided to call it No Girls, because my assistant, Vigneron, has a great palette. She's super talented, and I really wanted to give her carte blanche on this project and to develop her craft as well. And I thought there was like everything came together. And one of the things I would like actually to add is like my aunt in Burgundy was the first woman actually to graduate from Oenology and Viticulture School in Beaune in 1970.
Wow.
as well. And I really enjoy working with women in wine industry. Personally, I think they have better palate than men.
Better everything.
Better everything and less ego.
Well.
So that's the reason why I really enjoy working with Elizabeth. And now we have an assistant vigneron, and that's her name is Karen as well. So I'm surrounded by those very talented women.
So is the building a tasting room or?
The building for the time being is vacant. Okay. And we have idea actually to renovate the buildings and to turn the building into some of our office and some other crazy project maybe.
So it was the inspiration for the name and the brand.
Absolutely.
Now let's talk about the wines. There's a La Paciencia vineyard. Is that your vineyard?
This is one of our vineyards, absolutely.
You make a couple of wines.
So actually three wines. So Elizabeth produced a Syrah, a Grenache, and a Tempranillo. It's a 10-acre block, and there's a third of each. A
couple of wines from La Paciencia, and you source... Or you have other vineyards, like for the... Or it's all La Paciencia.
It's all La Paciencia. Okay. And the production is about 300 cases per wine.
Okay. That's it.
And that's it.
Jesus.
So we like to create basically kind of tea. It's a tease, unfortunately. You know, I mean, we could produce and sell twice as much of La Paciencia, but we just don't have the land.
So I could validate that and tell you a little story. So I've been a wine collector since the 90s. And like every old Jewish guy from New York, I started with Napa cabs. But I've, you know, my love is the Northern Rhone, Barolo, all that stuff. And I was on every wine list from Harlan to Schaefer to David Abreu. And as I became more aware, Saxum and Cayuse, you know, these are guys that are making amazing wine. I think it took me 6-7 years to get on your wine list.
Okay? At the time.
I probably applied, I don't know, 10 years ago. I've probably been on it for 3 years. You know, I buy whatever I can get. You guys are so gracious with, you know, library wines. And if there's any stuff available, you could put in for it. And I usually get a lot of it. But one of the fun and interesting things was out of nowhere pops up a thing where we're sending you a No Girls Lucky 8.
Double lucky, number 8.
Nothing to do with, you know, me being involved with No. It was, I was as a Cayuse thing. So how does that come about?
It unfortunately came during the pandemic because every first weekend in April, we invite our customers on the Cayuse list, our friends and clients, to come to Walla Walla, spend the weekend there, visit wineries there, of course, enjoy wonderful food, and then come to the Cayuse weekend, taste some futures, some wines from Burles, and also pick up the wine they purchased the previous year. And the last couple of years, we could not do it, unfortunately. And that's the reason why I said, look, we have that great wine. It's a new wine.
Do something.
Well, and I want to send a thank you message to everyone across all the list there, because without people on the list, we'll not be where we were. And during the pandemic, we did not get affected at all.
In fact, we probably bought more wine.
We sold more wines than ever. That's the reason why that was like a thank you from everyone from the bottom of our heart at Bionic Wines. So we ship a bottle of Double Lucky to everybody across the list. That means 6,500 bottles of wines.
I've never seen social media blow up when that came out. It was like the coolest thing. And it's highly collectible and very cool. I'm afraid to open it.
You should open it. This is our approach to a fine.
That's the reality. Don't sit on it. Don't sell it.
Enjoy the wine. Drink it.
I agree with that. So that's No Girls Wines. You introduce a Tempranillo in there, which is very cool. And you said Grenache, right?
Grenache. It's a blend of Grenache, Syrah, and Tempranillo.
Right. So that's No Girls. Again, they have, you know, a beautiful website. You can also go to Bionic Wines. All right. So finally, we get to your first vineyard, Cayuse, which dates back to the mid-1990s, 96, 97. It's easy to say this is the winery that really launched Christoph Baron. You saw what you wanted. You got in there. You did what you wanted. It's truly your flagship winery. right?
Absolutely.
So tell me a couple things. Tell me what's going on there now. And we've talked about it through the interview, but tell me a little about, Cayuse. We knew how you got there, the stones and all of that. But what's going on there now? And, let's talk about some of the wines. You make more wines there. I don't know, like 8, 10 a dozen, not necessarily every year, right? At Cayuse?
At Cayuse, we have 13 wines.
13.
13 wines now for a total production of roughly 4,500 cases.
That's it?
That's it.
No wonder why it took so goddamn long to get on the waiting
list. There's about 15,000 people on the waiting list.
That's it.
And unfortunately, because my dream will be actually to increase the production to offer a three-pack to everybody that have been waiting to get the wine. This being said, when you draw a line in the sand, there's not only wine in life.
Right. Right. Does that mean acquisition of more property to?
Oh, now we have 70, with all the different projects, 70 acres of vineyards planted. We have another almost 20 acres to plant. And I already promised to my team, this is it.
You don't want to go beyond a certain level.
70 acres, it's already planted.
You want to do your business and the quality.
Well, absolutely.
So you will up the amount of wine you make, but at some point you want to cap it.
Absolutely. That means like we are going to increase a little bit the production of horsepower because there is a new vineyard coming in production. So that means that there is potential to get on a list there. But otherwise, after that's it. I'm done with wine.
So I left Cayuse last because that was your first winery. And that's really where you formulated, what you want to do. It's a very Rhone-driven wine. So let's talk about, some of the wines. I don't want to say bigger production, but the more well-known.
The Cayuse
Syrah? The Cayuse Syrah, with the yellow-orange label. That's really the flagship, right?
That's the flagship. This is the first vineyard we planted. And this is actually our biggest production of Syrah from a single vineyard, roughly 750 cases every year. And this one is unique also, Sam, because this is the only Syrah that is co-fermented with a small amount of Viognier, 5 to 6% Viognier every year.
But that's the old school way in a way, right? Where you add a little Viognier in the Rhone?
In the Rhone, absolutely.
Yeah.
This being said, there is some great 100% Syrah in Côte Rôtie as well.
Oh, yeah.
Right?
No argument for either side. Also, you sort of created one of the nice things, and this represents that, is you were one of the first guys to do very playful labels, very colorful, mm-hmm. Art. Now it's kind of a common thing. People are pressing, how crazy they can go. How did Bionic Frog come about?
Bionic Frog, this is my nickname that I heard when I was working in the Barossa Valley in Australia.
So Frog, you're a Frenchman. Bionic, because you're just crazy going all the time?
Kind of.
So you're the Bionic Frog.
I was the Bionic Frog. Exactly.
You named the wine after yourself.
I named the wine after myself, and I thought, actually, it's going to be, let's make it a funny and whimsical label, kind of cartoonish label. And I created the Bionic wine, actually, in honor of one of my mentors. From Cornas, a great vigneron, Noël Verset.
Who no longer makes.
Unfortunately, Noël Verset passed away. And
wines are very coveted and hard to get.
Yes, and I love those wines. And this is because of him. He pushed me actually to use Old Cluster. At the time, I was not using Old Cluster. The first vintage, 97, 98, 99, all the Syrahs, they were destemmed. And then when I showed him, my first Syrah, we tested in his little kitchen in Cornas on the Formica table. And he said, you destem all the fruit there, right?
He knew
and I
right
said,
away.
Yes, he knew right away.
He could tell from the character there wasn't
absolutely
that, whatever the stems add.
Absolutely. And he said, you should try actually some stems. Go slow, 25%, and see how you like it. And then from there, go 50 and so on. And I followed his advice, and definitely this is because of Noel that have developed that style in Washington very, very early. Now it seems like it's kind of the new trend.
Yeah.
Old cluster. And
carbonic somewhere.
Soon. Yeah. But back in the days, that was something new.
So we talked about this earlier, and I think maybe even off air, about whole cluster. On a lot of the Cayuse wines, most of it is all whole cluster or high percentage, or like you said, you vary by vintage.
We vary by vintage, but between the Grenache and the Syrah, anywhere between 60 to 90 and sometimes more.
So it's significant.
Percent.
The whole yes. cluster is significant. So that's Cayuse. There's a lot of wines going on there. If you have a chance to taste them, please do. They are highly coveted. It's a mailing list thing. You know, we hate to talk about that. I mean, I'm in love with Christoph and his wines, but I didn't bring him on to show you a guy whose wines are hard to get, but they're hard to get. But, you know, be aware of that. Put your name on the mailing list now. I hate to ask this question because I don't know if it makes sense or not. But you make wines that are not cheap. And I think everything's justified. And I think people should know that. I mean, if you are looking for special wines and you know special wines have a price that come to them, you know, these are some of these wines. But you also make a few wines that are pretty good value compared to like Edith and what is it? Campaspello?
Campaspello. Well, this is our rosé of Grenache. It's $45, I believe, something like that. And for a rosé, it's not cheap. It's pretty high.
No, but for your wines, it's, you know, you get to get into that barn and you get to taste all of that.
Right.
But I didn't bring that up. I just want people to know, you know, that these are the top of the class as far as wines, and the way you do that, you know, they're worth every penny. Now that we laid everything out, you know, that you have these multiple vineyards, that you are a vigneron in France, how do you split your time? And I guess there's two questions. One is, how do you split your time between the U.S. and Champagne? Because you do have a family there. You have taken over the vineyards. You have production. And then you have multiple vineyards in Walla Walla. So it's sort of like, you can't hang too long at any one place. So how's the juggle? You know, how do you do that?
It's, in fact, it's very easy.
Oh, really?
It's called working with the best team. It's all about the team. I'm lucky I have some vision, but you can have the best vision without the people. Nothing gets done. All right, so we are all on the same boat there, and I've got my cousins in Champagne and my sister Isabelle, who runs the side of the business in Champagne. So I don't have to worry. They know exactly what I want. I mean, they are like great professionals there. And in the United States, in Walla Walla, I've got also the best team. And the fun about being in one business for me is also working and always putting the dream team together. It's all about that, working with people, the respect of the people, because without the people, from the vineyards, hands-on, to sales or in the office, nothing gets done.
That, I can't agree with that answer anymore. It's all about people and getting the job done through people. So identifying the right people is important and how you manage them. And obviously you've been successful and people like Elizabeth have been around.
Since 2008.
You seem to be doing it right. All right. So I'm going to tell people towards the end of the show where they can get more information. But we do a thing on the Grape Nation called the Wine List. Nobody leaves the show without asking 5 questions. We've asked every guest that's passed through this podcast these 5 questions, and you ain't getting away from it. So I'm going to ask you one at a time. The first question is, what are you drinking now? Not us tasting horsepower, but what do you like to experiment with? What's in the refrigerator? Do your tastes change because of the seasons? You know, if I looked on your table at home or opened your fridge, what are you drinking?
A lot of Champagne Pinot Meunier.
Why? That's what you make.
Why? Because there's more Pinot Meunier Champagne being produced.
So you want to taste other stuff?
I want to taste them. I want to taste them because for me, it's like the connection, the single thread to meet with new growers in Champagne and actually make new friends.
Okay.
And we all have something in common. We're crazy about quality. So that's why I'm tasting a lot of Pinot Meunier right now.
So that's as much as you can get. All right, that's a great answer, and it makes total sense. Tell me the next question's a little of the silliest of the five, but do you have a favorite wine and food pairing? Not something you necessarily eat every week, month, or whatever, but is there something in your mind that, you know, is just a terrific combination of food and wine?
Oh, there's so many, especially when you love great wine and great food.
What comes to the top?
I will say that nothing can beat a great Burgundy. For me, that will be to the top, a great Burgundy with a jambon persillé.
What is that?
A jambon persillé.
Jambon is ham?
A jambon persillé, yeah.
What does persillé mean?
Persillé is with parsley.
Oh, okay. Very simple.
Very, very simple.
Okay. Is it roasted or baked?
No, not at all. It's baked and it comes in a terrine.
It is a terrine. Okay.
A terrine, so it's served cold, a slice of it, with a nice little salad with a light vinaigrette, some cornichon, some beautiful baguette, and a great Burgundy.
Excuse my ignorance. It's almost like a charcuterie in a way. Okay. So Burgundy goes great with that. Many regions in Burgundy. Does it matter what Burgundy or any specific area? It doesn't matter.
I would say a Chambol. A premier cru Chambol.
Okay, there you go. All right, that's how you answer that question. All right, this you're going to have to focus a little. I ask everyone their favorite wine restaurant and or bar and a place that you walk into where they have a great list. Doesn't have to be the most expensive or the fanciest. The people that work there know their stuff. The vibe at the place is good. It could be Paris. It could be Champagne. It could be Walla. I don't care. What's a place that you know that when you walk in, it's going to be good?
There's so many of them. And you can give me a couple.
Does anything jump out at you? Because I don't want you to exclude anyone. Like, hey, Christoph, I heard that interview. Why don't you mention us? Let's assume you love them all, but...
Well, let me tell you something. If there's one place, it's my house. It's my parents' house, and it's my mom's cooking.
Okay. That's a good one, and that's very politically correct. Now, do your parents collect wine to some extent? Back vintages, walk downstairs, they have some cool stuff? Not too crazy, or...?
For my dad, it's impossible to keep wine.
Why? He drinks it?
He drinks it.
That's sort of what you're pushing. Don't keep the no girls. Drink it.
Well, drink it. But the thing is, actually, I've got a cellar also in France that I share with my dad. And it's very, very interesting because on some of the bottles, I have to put a little note. It's like, do not open without me. Because usually I tell him, Dad, I mean, when you are with friends, go down to a cellar and you're welcome actually to pick. Pick up whatever whatever you want. Well, guess what? Just a little story. I went back to France this May for after a year and a half, and I went down to a cellar and I saw right away, spotted that there was a magnum of Noël Verset 1997 that was gone.
Ooh.
So I went back up and I asked the dad. I said, "What, Dad? What happened to that magnum? How was it?" And he goes like, "I don't know." I said, "What do you mean you don't know?" I said, "I was invited at friend's house on a Sunday for lunch, and I took that magnum as a gift."
Oh.
And I said, "You did not open that magnum?" He said, "No." I said, "You have to go see Denis. His name is Denis.
Taste it.
And you asked Denis to open that magnum with you."
That's funny. That's a good story. Well, that means your father has a good heart.
Absolutely.
You know, good for him. All right, fourth question. Favorite all-time wine? When I first started the show and you asked me how long I've been doing it, I've been doing it for years. I initially asked the question, Christoph, what was that? What was the rarest, most expensive wine you ever had? You know, the Verset. I don't care about that. What's that wine throughout your career, whether with your parents or making, what's that wine that was important to you, that was a gateway wine, that changed the way you thought about things? Is there a wine in your...
Oh, my goodness. There are several wines.
Well, and several I have to is good, too.
Several is good, too, but I have to choose the very first.
Which is?
And it's a bottle of Krug, Champagne Grand Année. And it was back in 1985.
Did you know about Krug then?
Well, of course, the family about...
Dumb question. Your champagne.
Krug and you know, the top cuvée, Krug, Cristal, Dom Pérignon, and et cetera, et cetera. But this one, I remember vividly because there was the first time, I was 15 at the time, that my dad opened that bottle for a Sunday lunch. And I smelled that wine, and it was like just something like unbelievable. The aroma was so perfect. Like for a young kid like me, 15-year-old, and I taste the wine, and that it was so lush and so beautiful. And I'm like, this is what I want to do.
That's...
I want to be a vigneron. And then I told my parents that at that lunch, I said, Dad, Mom, please send me to Avis. I would like to become like you, Dad, a vigneron.
That was your
That
was your gateway wine. That's how you answer the question. You know, like I said, it's far from being the rarest or the most expensive, but for sure the most important. All right, final question. This may be a little tougher for you because I have Psalms on and, you know, some winemakers and all that. But I ask my guests to tell me what they think the best wines around 15, 20, 22 bucks American are, red and white. So I'm going to change the question a little. I want you to think about, when you think about where the best value in wine is, where is it in a white? Where is it in a red? And I always say this, like if you think about Muscadet, they make terrific wines for not a lot of money. And boy, you open a bottle with some oysters. What do you think are good value? Like, hey, if I see my kids, I was just with Christoph. This is what he said you guys should buy that's not that expensive. What comes to your mind?
For me, the wine from Languedoc-Roussillon.
Okay. That's... You're not the first guy who said that.
Best value, white and red.
Best quality. Best quality best
for
range.
The buck.
Right.
Absolutely. And it's a shame that it's the biggest wine region in France. Actually, in the world, too, one of the biggest in the world. But it's very confusing because it's so big. But it's definitely for everybody, for millennials, for everyone. It's every day, there's a lot of everyday wine there. So
there
There is.
And there's a lot of organic, low intervention biodynamics there, as much as anywhere.
Absolutely. In France.
Yep.
In France. So that's the reason.
That's the reason why. All this.
That's the reason why I would say for both white and red, go there.
I agree. And I think that's, you know, a fair answer. All right. So that's the wine list. I didn't tell you that we post this on social media. Our listeners love to hear what our guests are talking about. So we will post that in the next few days. All right. We're coming down to the end of the show, but every week we do a segment called the Weekly Wine Sip where we taste a different wine on air. I asked you if you would like to taste the wine on air with me. And not only did you comply, but you sent me three bottles. But you and I decided that we were going to taste the 2014 Horsepower. And Horsepower is the vineyard we talked about where everything is farmed with workhorses. So it's an interesting vineyard and it's a Syrah based. So, Christoph, we have in front of us the 2014 Horsepower, one of your vineyards. It's called The Tribe. It's Syrah. So here's my questions. Is it all Syrah? Tell me about The Tribe Vineyard. Tell me about 2014. We know about the vineyard, Horsepower. So let's talk about it. And then I want to throw it over the tongue and evaluate it a little.
Absolutely. So first of all, yes, it is 100% Syrah. It's located right next to the Enchamberlain Vineyard. Right there. And the wine, basically, I think this one was about 90% old cluster. and it doesn't see any new oak. It's all neutral demi-muit, 600 liters that are like anywhere between 25 years old to 10 years old. So definitely no new oak in here. This wine spent about a year and a half in a demi-muit. It was racked only once.
Racked means racked into smaller lees, barrels? Or
of the lees. Okay. After a malolactic. And then after that, that spent over a year, almost a year and a half in demi-muit. It's bottled, unfined, and unfiltered. We don't filter our wine. We don't fine, just to preserve the quality and the essence of all the aromas there and the hard work in both the vineyard and the wine studio. And I decided actually to share with you, Sam, the 2014, because I really love this vintage. For me, it's a classic Walla Walla vintage.
What makes a classic? Just the weather? I mean, the way everything played out?
Absolutely.
Or was it difficult? And sometimes difficult years make good wines.
Good wine. It means for us, it's like it was a little cooler, and it did reach physiological ripeness toward the end of September, early October, at lower bricks. That means like more or less you'll end up with a wine with 13.5% alcohol. So this is what I'm looking for, even though we harvest when the fruit is ripe and not overripe. So that's the reason why I think it's definitely very classic in the mid-30s, 13% alcohol. And then just the elegance that you have from the vintage.
I get all of that. All right, so we're going to evaluate it. And it's not really evaluating. I want to talk about it. So the color is a fairly deep, dark purple. Not black, but
translucent. You can see through the wine.
And when you said unfined, unfiltered, it's a pretty clear wine.
Absolutely.
You know. So the color, is this classic as far as color for what you go for?
Yes, absolutely. Especially when you use a lot of old cluster then.
Right. You're dealing with stems and all that.
Stem and then.
All right. So that's the color. I'm going to defer to you. Let's do the nose. Tell me what you get on the nose and tell me if that pairs to classic, you know, Rhone Syrahs.
What I'm getting on the nose, because it is a 2014 wine. So this wine is 7 years old. So starting
to bottle age.
Starting to develop some secondary aroma. This being said, this wine has a lot of meat quality. It's very meaty. It's very bloody. When we opened the wine a little over an hour ago, I said...
You said right away.
Right away, it's liquid steak tartare. A lot of bloodiness.
which is a characteristic of the region. Tell people what Côte Rôti means.
Well, Côte Rôti means like a very roasted...
slope?
Heel. Yeah. Slope.
Yeah, right. It's a roasted meat too.
Meat.
Almost. Yeah,
almost there.
All right, so that's the nose. What do you get? Dark fruits or what? What other characteristics?
On the nose, also I get like a beautiful salinity. I get a lot of soy sauce. I get some black truffle. It's that black truffle starting really to transpire right now, and also a lot of blackberry. It is very, very black fruit.
Very black, and like you said earlier, and I think it was off the air, it's incredibly savory. And you did mention umami. And by that suggestion, now that I'm tasting it, you know, those are the predominant, you know, qualities. All right, mouthfeel. Let's throw it over to the tongue.
Very smooth tannin, very nice.
Smooth integrated tannins. Medium plus mouthfeel.
Mouthfeel.
Not thin, not unctuous, but mouth filling.
Definitely well balanced, very fine grain, velvety.
No grain.
And actually, it's very mouth coating, and you get some kind of like it's very wavy. You almost get like.
What does that mean? I've never heard that before.
Very wavy for me is like, it's almost you get like a. It starts from the front, then the middle, and it expands on the side. So you think of a triangle from the front of the tongue to the back of the palate, and that's what I mean about like
wave. So as it's moving, it's not just moving back, it's moving back and out.
Out.
Absolutely. I got you. I get that.
And it's very long. The length, it's there.
Oh, yeah. It's still in there. All right. Let's talk about palate. Does the palate replicate the nose? We talked about that savory, umami, blackberry. When you taste it.
Absolutely. For me, I get a lot of tapenade, black olive tapenade. I've got a lot of briny character. So it's there.
It's crazy.
It's the same thing right there.
It's crazy, man.
Right.
So the palate is very savory. You introduce tapenade, which again is another savory saline, you know, type things.
Quality.
It's very much like a northern one, like a Saint Joseph or.
It is kind of yes and no for a simple reason.
I know the yes. Tell me the no.
The no, we are not trying actually to duplicate what they are doing.
I wouldn't think
in the
you
northern,
would. It's
northern
just
road.
This.
This is what our beautiful terroir in the stone of the Walla Walla Valley has to offer.
So you, 97, 2007, 2017, 22. So 25 years later, you were right about the softball style stones and that terroir, because these are the wines that you're making.
I believe so.
No regrets.
Yes, no regret at all. If I had to do it again, I would start again.
Look
in
for
the
bigger stones. All right. So classically, what are great foods to pair with this wine?
Oh, the ranch is pretty big. I mean,
give me range wines. Like, what's something interesting on one range? Like,
I could go with poultry. They're roasted Dutch. Definitely a roasted dog. Also, like some red meat. I mean, of course, steaks, but you could go.
Good burger wine, right?
Sorry?
Good hamburger wine.
It could be, of course. Yeah. Why not? Lamb.
It would hold up to the fatty
to the
gaminess
fatty,
of the lamb.
Of the lamb. Like, yeah, definitely like some northern cuisine, northern African cuisine as well.
Sure,
with some spices.
It's all about the spices and the sauce, not always the meat.
Yep. And the herbs as well.
And the herbs, for sure. So those are good pairings. All right, so I think this wine's terrific. This is the 2014 horsepower, the Tribe Vineyard, 100% Syrah, whole cluster, right? All right, so I'm going to tell you where to get everything. Christoph, we have to wrap up the show. I told you we would run long, but I have no problems with that. Let me do a quick wrap-up, and I want to get some info from you. So if you have a question, suggestion, wine happening, or event, hit me up at sam@thegrapenation.com. That's sam@thegrapenation.com. Subscribe to the Grape Nation podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your pods. Follow us on Facebook at The Grape Nation. On Instagram, we're at SBenRuby. On Twitter, we're at BenRuby. I know that can be confusing. But on the two of those, you can always use the hashtag TheGrapeNation, and you'll get to everything. As I mentioned, we will post Christoph's wine list. He had some interesting recommendations. So I will post that on social media. And I will give you all the details on this terrific 2014 horsepower Tribe. Christoph, if we want to find you and your wines on social media and the internet, where are the places we should go? It's never too late to get on the waiting list.
Absolutely. It's never too late. So you can www.bionicwines.com.
Bionicwines is a site that gets you to everything we discussed.
Absolutely. This is the umbrella.
Yes.
It's all the different projects.
I think
projects.
That's the best place. And this it's done well, by the way.
Right. And otherwise, we are on Facebook. And also Instagram under Bionic Wine.
Okay.
As well.
Do you have a personal account or you do everything through Bionic Wine?
Through Bionic Wines.
Okay. All right. So I want to thank our guest, Christoph Barron. Christoph, thank you for sitting down with us. We had a lot to cover and I think we got to most of it. I want to thank all our engineers at Heritage for putting all this stuff together and also everyone else at Heritage Radio Network. I'm Sam BenRuby and you've been listening to The Grape Nation.
Thank you very much, Sam.
Boom. The Grape Nation is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/Heritage Radio Network. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. And thanks for listening.